It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. All right, I want to learn about connections between emerging markets and the energy sector. And here to help us is Damian Sassauer. He's our fixed income strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. Damian, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with me. Can you explain what exactly are we trying to understand here? A connection that I didn't realize existed.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, emerging markets, especially the debt issued by emerging market oil and gas companies, tends to be more tightly correlated to the sovereign parent countries in which they're located, right? And so one would think it's an oil company, it produces oil, and so its business, its emerging, you know, it's the spreads for its debt should be more correlated to the price of oil, but that's just not the case.
What give us an example? I mean, what are you talking about? Brazil?
So Brazil is an interesting case because
Petrobras is basically owned by the Brazilian government, isn't it?
Yeah, about 60%. So you would think that it would, but nevertheless, it produces oil. I mean, it's got upstream and downstream businesses, but Petrobras, for the most part, and has historically had a very tight correlation to the price of oil, but it's the correlation between Petrobras bond spreads and that of its of Brazil itself are just, I mean, they're upwards of 80%, close to 90%. Although that's been declining of late, in lieu of all the political instability that's going on the ground, right? So I think what's happening is you might have creditors a little bit more desensitized to the political turmoil surrounding Michel Temer and
they're just exhausted by it because that goes back to the previous administration and then the previous administration in Brazil. And also there was a big corruption scandal at Petrobras.
That's correct. So, I mean, as opposed to perhaps what's going on in Mexico, right? I mean, what's interesting about Pemex, which is the large, and that is, you know,
state-owned oil company
in Mexico, exactly. The spreads of quite frankly, of Pemex are more tightly correlated to that of Mexico. And Mexico, given what's been going on with NAFTA renegotiations and trade linkages to the U.S., what you're finding is that Pemex bond spreads are more tightly correlated to U.S. financial conditions. So U.S. money markets, right? The front end of the yield curve. So, you know, with all that's going on here with the removal of quant easing and perhaps, you know, quant tightening going forward, and you're just finding that Pemex spreads are more closely tracking that of the U.S. than of its sovereign parent.
Do we need to note that this is also because the companies, these oil and energy companies, they are so closely linked to the governments of these emerging economies like Mexico, like Brazil? I mean, it's not as if these are what we would consider to be private shareholder-owned companies.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, Petrobras and Pemex are definitely quasi-sovereign entities that are, you know,
they're not going to do anything that the central government, that the government doesn't want them to do.
But I can direct your attention to a company in Russia by the name of Lukoil, right? And Lukoil is not owned by the government, and yet its spreads track that of the Russian sovereign upwards of 90%. So it's not as if it's a public-private, quasi-sovereign, corporate, you know, issue here. What you're finding is that emerging market companies, that the embedded sovereign risk in their bond spreads, it just outweighs the fundamentals. And we've seen that, right? Fundamentals, you know, for the most part, I don't want to say they don't matter anymore, but we've been in this one-way street, this one-way environment for EM debt. And so, you know, you're finding that they're tracking sovereign bond spreads pretty closely.
All right, I'm going to push back with you on Russia because you mentioned Lukoil. Okay, very good. It is a private company. It is not run by the government, but it happens to be in Russia. And forgive me, but I think that Vladimir Putin casts a very wide shadow over every aspect of the Russian economy. So it's not like Lukoil is going to do something that the Russian energy ministry doesn't like.
Nah, that's absolutely true. But 80% of its revenue is coming from abroad, right? It's not Gazprom. So look, what we have is,
you make a good point. I mean, this is that the political context is crucial when you're looking at emerging market debt.
And that's the point here. I mean, you just can't ignore the sovereign risk. I mean, anybody who's going to do a deep dive and do a fundamental bottom-up analysis on any EM issuer, you just can't ignore the political risk that's embedded within bond spreads.
Well, I was going to say, next we should go to Venezuela, right? PDVSA.
Well, PDVSA is an interesting one, right? I mean, now that we've seen, all the talk about, the U.S. upping sanctions and everything that's going on the ground there, I mean, it's a real crisis. And so what you've seen there is you've seen credit default swap spreads blow out. And what that's done is it's increased the implied probability of default from something like 55% to upwards of 72% over the last month. That's a huge move. And in so doing...
And someone's made a lot of money on this, right? Because someone has bet that, I mean, obviously someone bought the credit default swaps when they were low and people thought there wasn't going to be a problem. And this is like, you're hoping that you're going to get into an automobile accident and then you benefit because the premium skyrockets.
Well, just from... But that's true if you're kind of playing, if you're a trader mentality and you're playing the CDS spreads, but if you're a cash bond holder in PDVSA, right, and you're a long-term investor, you know, what you're seeing is people have kind of been playing the front end because, you know, every time there's, you know, they're going to default, they don't default. And so the bonds pay out and they mature and they redeem and you get 100%, 100 cents on the dollar. But all those short end bonds, especially the ones that are coming due toward the end of the year that are trading at 70, 80, 90 cents on the dollar, they've come down quite a bit and people are moving further out along the curve simply because your risk of loss is less. Think about it. If you're paying 80 cents for a PDVSA bond and it defaults, you lose 80 cents. But if you're paying 35 cents for the 2027s or the 2034s, your risk of loss is that much less. So you're seeing, long-term investors moving out along the curve, and that's what's going on with PDVSA.
That's interesting because, I mean, that really highlights how people are reacting to try to reduce their risk, but at the same time, they're looking for more yield.
Yeah. And PDVSA, actually, I just ran the numbers. It's actually the only oil and gas issuer in EM hard currency land that is actually down on the year. But if you look at it over, I mean, my goodness, if you look at it over the last 2 years, I think it's up, 80%, so you can't ignore PDVSA if you're kind of a closet beta chaser, an index tracker, if you will. You have to have it in the portfolio. It's just, where do you want to put your points on the curve?
Thanks very much for explaining this. Very interesting. Thanks, as always. Damian Sassauer, he is our fixed income strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence, giving us some detail about emerging market debt and the connection between the oil companies in those countries and the value of their debt. All right, I want to turn our attention now to the hospitality industry, in as much as Marriott has released its results, and also we'll be getting a preview of Priceline. I want to bring in Dan Wasliak. He is the senior equity analyst at Morningstar. And Dan, let's begin with Marriott, because yesterday they said they've putting together this partnership with Alibaba Group in China because, of course, they want to tap into the growing market for tourism and travel amongst Chinese individuals. Can you speak to what you learned from Marriott's report today?
Yeah, I guess with Alibaba, we didn't find that too surprising. I think it makes sense for Marriott, and in the future, I expect other hotel operators to join a platform like Alibaba, given that they have 500 million active monthly users. That's a platform that you're going to want shelf space on, especially, given China is a growing outbound travel market. So this is something that should help Marriott's long-term growth opportunity in China, where currently about 8% of their total rooms are from that region. But beyond that, what we learned out of the quarter was that their brand continues to be very strong. And also the U.S. corporate business spend seems to be pausing a little bit, and that's kind of been echoed by some other competitors in the hotel space over the last week or two.
All right, we'll get to the bigger issue in just a second. I want to ask you about Marriott and Starwood. How is the that combination coming along? Because didn't they say that they want to cut $250 million in dollars from the company's budget?
Right. Yeah. So everything appears on track. You know, they acquired Starwood back in September of last year. It was a good acquisition in that Marriott was more focused on U.S. and Starwood had more of an international exposure. So that was a nice marriage from that vantage point. But yeah, everything appears on track as far as the synergies that they expect to strip out of the Starwood integration. The $250 million in cost savings, they remain on track to have that annualized sometime next year.
Dan, this is considered an asset light strategy. Is that correct?
Right, right.
And maybe explain, how does that work and why is that of benefit, particularly when it comes to margins?
Yeah, so they don't own a lot of their own hotels. They depend on third parties to really join the platform, and therefore they don't have a lot of development capital intensity costs. That's all forwarded by the third parties that are joining Marriott. And the reason they're joining Marriott is because Marriott has a leading loyalty program. They have strong brands, and they also have a good website of traffic. So those are the things that a third party will look to when they're looking, for example, to franchise under one of the larger brands. And also, Marriott doesn't have to pay for any of the marketing costs. All that is again, paid for by these third parties. So the margins are very high versus if you own the hotels, those costs are going to be associated with that.
Because those franchise fees, as well as the incentive fees, they continue to increase the revenue at Marriott and doesn't cost them any more money.
Right? Yeah, that's essentially correct, right? So there's a lot of leverage here as they continue to sign up and get unit growth. The costs are very low, and they get a percentage of the revenue that's generated by these franchisees.
Is this the model that you think most hospitality hotel groups should follow?
I do, but you know, it's also a matter of scale. So when you're a smaller hoteler, you really have to kind of invest your own capital behind the brands in order to get them to a point where third parties can gain confidence in the brand development. So you look at a company like Hyatt, for example, that is has more of an owned exposure. They're starting to get to the point now where they're approaching 200,000 total rooms, where I think they're starting to realize that third parties now believe in the brands that they've put their own where Hyatt's put their own capital behind. So it's kind of an evolution that a company gets into where it becomes more asset light as it builds a certain scale.
Now, Priceline is set to release its results after the close of trading today. The shares of Priceline are up nearly 40% so far this year. $2,043. Stock is up $1.23 right now. What do you expect to hear from Priceline?
Well, first of all, our long-held view is that Priceline is the best-positioned company within online travel. The question now is it the best stock? We think that it's actually near fair value. Our fair value is $2,030, essentially where the stock is trading right now. But, you know, as far as the report, we expect it to be solid. Expedia reported their results 2 weeks ago. They saw a pretty solid macro environment globally. Expedia's room nights also saw some acceleration versus the prior quarter. And then even though there's been some mention of U.S. corporate pause with the hotelers, they also point out that the leisure market, which is more of Priceline's forte, that the leisure market is quite strong. So we think that the quarter probably is going to be quite solid for Priceline.
Can you speak about this idea of, you know, the competition from Airbnb, so vacation rentals? How does that play into Priceline's strategy?
Yeah, vacation rentals is a growing market within online travel. And one of the reasons why we like Priceline is because Priceline actually has a really strong vacation rental platform. So Priceline has about 1.2 million properties and 25 million rooms on Booking.com. And of those 25 million rooms, about 8 million or so are vacation rentals or alternative accommodations, which would compare with Airbnb, which probably has around 3 or 4 million rooms itself on its platform. So Priceline actually has a very competitive offering to Airbnb. And we think that of the total bookings, vacation rentals probably represent a low double digit of Priceline's total bookings.
And you think that at fair value, what is the alternative? If you don't like the price of Priceline, what should you do?
Well, TripAdvisor, I think the market is greatly probably discounting TripAdvisor that also has a pretty good platform. There's a lot of traffic that goes to TripAdvisor.
Right.
TripAdvisor has a lot of content.
And they'll be announcing their results at the close of trading today as well.
They will be, yes.
Yeah. So, thanks very much. Dan Wasilek, he is a senior equity analyst at Morningstar, talking about the hospitality industry.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Well, what are the characteristics that a money manager looks for in an investment? Here to tell us is David Kudla. He is the chief executive and the chief investment strategist for Mainstay Capital Management, helping to manage more than $2 billion based in Grand Blanc, Michigan. And he can be followed on Twitter at David_Kudla. That's K-U-D-L-A. All right, David_Kudla. What are the characteristics? What are you looking for in an investment right now?
Right now, we're looking for investments that can do well in a slow growth economy. And those are the sectors that are more dependent on a secular growth story than they are the economy and cyclical forces. The economy is doing okay, but it's really just sputtering along at about 2% GDP growth. So we've seen value stocks have really suffered this year. Growth stocks have done very well, namely technology.
Are you going to stick with that, or is it time to rebalance?
We're going to stick with technology, and we're going to stick with big cap technology. We are in the ninth year of a bull market, and there will be a point where this market finally cracks after the over 8 years of the second longest bull market in the history of U.S. stocks, where we'll see a problem with a flat or down market, and all stocks will suffer at that time. Until that time, when we look at where do we want to be in this market right now, past 6 months and right now, it's still with technology and even healthcare that tends to be economically insensitive.
Well, David, how do you know when to get out? I mean, the NASDAQ is up nearly 20% this year. The S&P 500 is higher by more than 11%. You know, no one's going to ring a bell for you when it's time. But how do you avoid that downturn, or how do you mitigate the effects?
Yeah, no one's going to ring a bell, although there are some people acting like they're ringing bells. At Oakmark Capital, Jeffrey Gundlach have words of caution. And we know that market has to have pessimist has to climb a wall of worry. But when we look at market fundamentals, primarily earnings are very strong and expected to be strong through 2017. So we think you stay with stocks for now. We're probably quite a bit more careful within the bond sector, staying away from those interest rate sensitive bond sectors.
Well, let's take one sort of tech giant as an example, Apple. The earnings that they recently posted, better than estimated, also looking into the future, saying that they think they're going to do better than analysts had previously thought. Is Apple characteristic of the kind of company you want to own?
It is. We saw iPhone sales come through very strong in the most recent quarter. They're continuing really to perform well with still a low PE relative to a lot of their peers. And when we look at the tax reform that may be coming, one of the primary ingredients in that is a way for those big companies like Apple to repatriate dollars. And that will be good whether it comes in the form of further investment or in financial engineering, stock buybacks, higher dividend payout.
So how do you respond to people that say, gee, you know, David, you're a momentum trader. You're going mm-hmm. with the momentum. You're adding to the positions that are doing well. As you just said, eventually that's not going to work forever.
eventually it won't work forever. But then we look for, as tactical asset allocators, where do we want to be in the next market environment? You know, right now, if people who are Warren Buffett or Graham Dodd type investors that have looked at value because it's undervalued, that's simply been a value trap. So momentum has worked very well this year. We think it continues to work well, and it will take us to other sectors as the market shifts.
Well, is a company like Tesla, do you consider that to be a technology company, an automobile manufacturer, a solar company? How would you parse Tesla?
All the above. It's a consumer, you know, we'd put it in the consumer cyclical category as an auto manufacturer primarily, but also you'll see it held in a lot of tech funds, technology stock funds, because of the technology incorporated in the overall business model in their products, you know, what Elon Musk is all about. But it's a technology stock that quite frankly concerns us quite a bit now, and that's because we have this Model 3 production ramp that we see we have a lot of concerns with. A cash burn rate we were concerned about until a couple of days ago when it was announced that there would be another bond offering to raise another $1.5 billion. But that's a company we can look at, not like Apple, at a low PE that's making a lot of money. Tesla is a company with no PE. They have no earnings, and it's a question of when and if they will ever be a profitable company. So we think owners of Tesla, we call it a story stock, and they've given Elon Musk and Tesla a pass on a lot of things because they believe in the future. But we think there's a lot of reality to set in the next 6 to 9 months for Tesla.
Well, it certainly hasn't stopped the stock because the shares are up more than 70% so far this year. Do you think that $1.5 billion bond offering that they're talking about, is that just an effort? They got to raise the money somehow, but they just don't feel they can dilute the current shareholders?
Yeah, and it's a good time. If you're going to the capital markets, a lot of companies do it. There's companies that are going and issuing debt to buy back their stock because capital is so cheap right now. So now's a good time to do it. But they also, we think it's a good time for Tesla to do it because they've had the rollout of the Model 3. The press has been very good. It was really a superb rollout. But as they get in production and encounter some of those production problems, the next year's service problems, it'll be a little tougher to go to the capital markets. Given that their cash burn rate, they're out of money in two to three quarters, I think it was very wise for them to do that at this time.
As far as this this effort on what you call secular growth, healthcare, what characterizes? Because I mean, healthcare is a broad section of the market. What particular areas of healthcare? Pharmaceuticals, health insurance,
healthcare providers. We saw a lot of revenue generated for those companies with Obamacare, and we've seen as the different packages have been put forth, legislation proposals by the House and then the Senate. The factors that the healthcare providers can continue to do well. So healthcare being a non-cyclical, a non-economically sensitive sector that has been on a growth tear, and we think that still a good place to be.
What would you say is the one question that you get most often now from investors?
When will the other shoe drop?
What do you tell them?
Will this bull market end? We know it will, right? Uh-huh. We know it will. And the further it goes, the more chances are, quite frankly, that it ends badly. But, I think that some of these, and people that have gone to cash or shorted this market over the past year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years.
They have definitely not done well. Indeed.
It has not worked out for them.
Thank you very much. David Kudla, he is the chief executive and the chief investment strategist for Mainstay Capital Management, helping to manage $2 billion, more than $2 billion in Grand Blanc, Michigan. Shares of Ralph Lauren and Michael Kors all moving higher today. Ralph Lauren up 8.5%. Michael Kors higher by 20%. And who says retail is dead? Well, maybe my next guest. Danielle DiMartino Booth is the founder of Money Strong, an economic consulting firm, former advisor, the Dallas Federal Reserve, and a Bloomberg Prophet. Bloomberg Prophets are professionals who offer actionable insights on markets, the economy, and monetary policy. And the contributors may have a stake in the areas that they write about. Well, Danielle DiMartino Booth, do you have a stake in Ralph Lauren? Meaning, do you have things in your closet that maybe you're not going to throw away now?
Well, I certainly have plenty of Jimmy Choo's. So I personally stand behind and endorse the Michael Kors news.
All right. Well, very good. So Michael Kors, $1.2 billion for Jimmy Choo. What do you make of today's retail report from Ralph Lauren and Michael Kors?
Well, I mean, it's not terribly surprising. There will be continued pockets of loyalty out there. I'm a perfect representative thereof. That being said, I'm completely price sensitive outside of my little spheres of loyalty, if you will. And I think that we continue to see that come out in the aggregate data, Pim.
So this idea that people will pay whatever is being asked for the things they really want, but everything else is just sort of up for grabs. It's all price driven.
It's kind of it's a lot of retail, if you will, has been commoditized. And that commoditization has happened via Amazon, as we all know and talk about until we're blue in the face.
Well, you've written a column that says back to school means more retail agony. Describe why you believe that to be so.
You know, I think that we saw an acceleration of the decline in brick and mortar retailers over the holiday season. It surprised even the most pessimistic analyst when it came down to the trajectory of store closures. And because I think many retailers, of course, as we've seen today, not all, but because I think many retailers are in a vulnerable position, I think it's feasible that we actually see some more bloodshed around the back-to-school season, which is the second most important time of the year for retailers after the holiday season.
All right, and is it worthwhile making a distinction between the retail corporations that only sell online versus those that have, you know, substantial store locations? Because I think, for example, Michael Kors has over like 830 stores right now.
You know, exactly. In fact, I was in a mall recently at gunpoint. My children had taken me to see an animated feature. And, you know, out of the corner of my eyes, I noticed a Michael Kors store. Now, I don't go into malls if I don't have to. But you are right. Their footprint is enormous. And that will come back to haunt them at some point as more of the second and third tier malls begin to close down.
Do you think that that's reflected in the Chinese trade numbers with the United States, that trade with China continues to be robust, and indeed the sale of and demand of Chinese products continues to rise?
You know, it does. I was fishing over the weekend in Maine with Leland Miller, who's the China Beige book, who runs the China Beige book, and he gave me, you know, he always says you use an eyedropper full of skepticism when you see these data. I'm not so sure that 5 months in a row of a growing surplus in China is reflective as much of true underlying improvement or Chinese politicians trying to make a statement to President Trump about some of the hard talk that he has on trade. I don't know if we can parse this as being a true trend or being more game theory at play because Trump continues to threaten trade wars.
Expand on that, if you can, about this potential for the conversation really being political rather than economic.
Well, again, you know, I don't think that anybody in the world, especially given what's going on in North Korea, wants to see the outbreak of a trade war. On the other hand, we saw just last week that the Japanese have indeed moved forward with tariffs on importing beef. So it might be one small
from the United States,
and from other countries as well. So these are small steps, but we've not seen any backing down in terms of threats of tariffs on steel imports into the United States. And these things never tend to end well. And again, you know, there's been a lot of weakness out of the Chinese trade data. I would put more stock in it than I otherwise would. I do say it's more than just political, given the deeper disappointment that we saw overnight coming out of Germany and its trade numbers, followed by weakness weakness the night before in its manufacturing industrial production figures.
All right. Now, if we sort of combine that with what is happening to the U.S. consumer and how they're managing to pay for all of the products that come from these countries, maybe just to tell us more about that.
Well, you know, what we have seen is extreme stickiness in services inflation in this country. And whenever we see that, in fact, a recent survey showed that parents are going to be spending more money on after-school activities, those are services, than they will be spending on products to get their kids ready for the back-to-school season, which brings us back to my column from last week. But the more we see in terms of sticky service price inflation, the less wherewithal the average household has to spend on any goods. So you'll see that continued tug of war moving forward as household strains continue to grow. Of course, we saw news out of Discover Financial last week, before that Capital One Financial, that we've seen credit card defaults continue to tick up.
Well, and also revolving credit, which obviously credit cards, you say is at a record. Is at a record right now?
Well, that's what Bloomberg reported last night. Yes. No, we have indeed seen that prior peak taken out. At the same time, though, the Fed senior loan officer survey data tell us that standards are tightening. I'm just going to sit back and try and figure out how this dynamic is going to play out, because it's apparent that households are reaching to their credit cards not to cover discretionary Ralph Lauren, Michael Kors type of spending, but rather to cover spending on necessities. If lenders are pulling back at the same time, tightening standards, you have to start to wonder if we're going to see that play out in an increase in mortgage defaults and a continued rise in automobile loan defaults.
Well, you mentioned tightened standards. What about tightening interest rates? Do you believe that the increase in interest rates that is foretold by the Federal Reserve will have a dramatic effect?
You know, I do. It's interesting. We have the ongoing battle between the hawks and the doves, and Bullard overnight saying there's not another rate increase. I think that if the Fed manages to follow through on its theory of balance sheet shrinking being on autopilot and a non-event for the markets, it wouldn't surprise me, Pim, if we were to see them follow that with a rate hike in December. And at some point, these continued rate hikes, one on top of the other, will make a difference in conjunction with LIBOR going away for the average U.S. household.
I want to thank you very much for joining us. Danielle DiMartino Booth is the founder of Money Strong, former advisor at the Dallas Federal Reserve, a Bloomberg prophet. And you can follow her on Twitter at DiMartino Booth. She's also the author of Fed Up. This is Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.